Here's a question maybe you've never really thought of before. Can a church grow too fast? Should we ever stop a church from growing? Well, let's talk about it.
You're listening to the Reach Right Podcast, the show dedicated to helping your church reach more people and grow.
Well, hey guys, I'm Thomas.
And I'm Ian.
And today we are doing our first ever mailbag episode. It's all comments from the Reach Right community that we're going to be diving into a little bit. And these are real questions that real people asked us.
Yeah.
And we want to just give our hot takes on them. The central theme, I guess, in the first question is going to be about can churches ever grow too much? Like, is church growth ever a problem because churches are growing too quickly? And so we'll dig into some of that. Yeah. But, man, I'm excited to dig into it, Ian.
Me too. You
know, we're 250 episodes, 5 years deep into this podcast, and
man,
we just get so many comments now. And we do have this promise that we respond to all comments, and we're sticking with it. We're still doing it. It's becoming someone's job to help us kind of get them to the right people,
and
making sure they get answered. But yeah, these are still really us answering them a lot of times on the comments, and then and then here today, you'll hear us.
Well, it goes without saying that we're very thankful that we have the opportunity to do this, that because of our, you know, subscribers and people that tune in, we're able to do this now. So thanks to all of you guys for sure. So, but so interesting topic on this one, right? So I guess you're right. The main one was from one question, which is basically, when does church growth become a problem? So, and it's a good question, right? Because as pastors and ministry leaders and all the pastors we work with, they're all focused on wanting to grow, right? So so it's good to actually address when could it become a problem, right? So
Why don't you go, why don't you lead off with it? Like kind of the comments.
I'll kick it off, and we'll give the first shout out and reference here to Nup North asked a couple of weeks ago, if you go above 150, you're above Dunbar's number. Everyone stops knowing everyone else, too many people. Therefore, a church should really have 2+ congregations after that, 2 or more, either by planting in the next month or, in the next town over, or by having several services per week. Otherwise, community cohesion starts to crumble. So this person up north, they reference this Dunbar's number. So I guess, what are our thoughts, Thomas, on Dunbar's number and too much over 150?
So this was kind of new to me. I had heard of this like concept before. I didn't really understand it, but we did some research. And so if you don't know, Dunbar's number is this theory that people can only have real relationships with about 150 people. That's kind of the number. And as to my thoughts on that, yeah, probably. Like I, at the most, I think to have real relationships and friendships with 150 people, I think that sounds about right. I'm sure it varies from person to person. All you introverts out there, or, you know, it's 2 for me is how many I can have. But realistically, I think that's kind of a just a tried and true fast rule that's there. As to like, what does that mean for churches? I am never willing to say that churches should stop growing quickly, or like you should slow down your growth. I just, as a pastor, I just can't do it. I understand the thinking behind it. Like you need to prepare a space for people. And if we can't disciple them, if we reach them this quickly, I think that's not like a, you don't have to solve the let's grow slower problem. You have to solve the let's disciple better problem, right? That's what you need to do in that case. So there's never a circumstance where I think we should ever say, let's stop reaching people for Jesus because there's just too many at this point.
Right.
So, and that's what I think the commenter is getting at, is that, you know, shouldn't you come up with some kind of strategy on how you handle this? And that's an interesting one, like, you know, planting another church the next town over. I think that the way that I would do it, and the way I do it in my church currently, is that you start to do things like you start to look at 2 services. That's something that kind of helps with that problem. And then I think that you also start to really lean into smaller gatherings on top of the large church gathering. There's something fun about being in a big group of people that are all praising the Lord together. Like, I don't know what it is. Like, I love worshiping with 12 people, but like the kind of things you can do, like worshiping with 500 people, is just a, it's really a cool atmosphere. And there's just a lot of synergy and stuff that happens that way. So I don't want to give that up. Right. But I think like things like small or life groups, those kinds of things are important.
Yeah.
Having classes that are more limited in size and scope where there can be relationship. And then you foster that kind of like regular relationship with those same people. I think that's the best way to do some of that kind of stuff. So I'm going to stand, I'm going to die on this hill. Like I will never say, slow down. Let's not reach people so well. I'm never willing to go there to kind of satisfy Dunbar's number. I think I will say that we do have to come up with discipleship solutions and assimilation solutions to solve for that.
You have to adapt and adjust. And I could speak to this a little. I agree with you, Thomas. Of course, again, I'm a member at a mega-sized church, have not always been pastored with you and everything at very small churches, been at members at smaller churches, churches under 1,000. And of course, now I'm at a church where in an actual service, there's several thousand. Now, I will say, do I say hey to every one of them? It's impossible. I still run into people that I know. And I'm talking right now about just the actual worship service. So not all the other things like we just mentioned. But there still will people that know that I go to the 10 a.m. service and that look for me in the concourse in the hallway. And I shake hands. I get a hug. I know where a good buddy of mine always sits, and I'll text him and make fun of him that the, you know, back of his head is getting grayer and all of that. And, you know, but I will say this, we have had to, as a now multi-campus church, yes, we've expanded with definitely more campuses. And we always say, if you're only in here just attending during the worship service, you're missing out and you're not growing. You know, so we've had sayings where we're big on small and where we're more of not like a huge church, but a small town. But we have to say those things and be very intentional with small groups, with different, like when you said, if it's certain amount of youth in one area and all of that, and the way that, like, I'm really happy my son, who's a middle schooler, you know, he's in eighth grade, and when he goes to the youth experience at our church, they get into small groups and at tables to be able to, with different leaders and everything. So we've had to adapt, and I agree. If it was just one big gathering and that was the only focus, a lot of growth would be missed out on. So absolutely.
Yeah, totally. So I think if we, like, just kind of to put a bow on this,
our
audience, I'm sure that if you're watching this, I would bet, I'm just kind of thinking of seasons in my life where I've been at large churches and small churches. There's no question that relationally within the church, it was easier at smaller churches. Like to build, like, fellowship came easier for me at smaller churches than large. I know enough about you, Ian, I think it's the same thing for you probably.
Oh, totally agree.
If that's, I'd wonder what our audience would say. And so it is something that, like, mega churches already have that reputation. Yep. It is something that you have to be very intentional about. But again, I just can't under any circumstances say that we'd never turn people away from the gospel because we're just not ready. We have to solve that problem in other ways, I would say. So,
well, we got a few more of these. So moving on to the next one, we have, what are the best strategies for growth for a struggling small church? And this came from, I'm sorry, Brian Francis, 2862. We're struggling to get people to come have about 15 people, but can seat 150. So again, the question would be, for this small of a church, 15 people, and other small churches even larger than this, you know, what are some of the best strategies?
Yeah, it's a good problem to have, Brian. I think that's awesome that you have 150 people, or 150 seats ready to be ready to welcome people.
Right,
it sounds like
right,
so that's
at
awesome.
Dunbar's cap. Yeah,
we're gonna be right there.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's so many things, and like we've done episodes on every single thing we could possibly think of for church marketing and helping churches grow. I have the advantage of I pastored a similar size church a decade or so ago, where we were about 30 or 40 people when I took over. So it's so tricky at that size because like you're just like you're not quite at critical mass yet, and you don't have a lot of the stuff in place that people expect from a church. So I think the only thing that like that really moved the needle for us is just finding ways to get people in the door for the first time and then making sure we have a really good assimilation process for them. And in most cases, that was me as the pastor bending over backwards to connect with people that visited for the first time. So, you know, it was going out, like if anybody came once, I would take them out to lunch. I'd buy them lunch and, you know, and just try to build relationship with them. Ian, you, I planted a church and you were our first member. You know, that's how we did that. And it was me, you know, we went to lunch together and we ate together and did coffee and devos. And I just, we poured into those kinds of things together. Right. So, so to the, that's the easier part, the assimilation, like go get coffee with people. Everybody can do that. Getting people in the door a little bit trickier. I think if I'm just getting going, I think a website that is, we just are working with a denomination or a group of a church planting organization called ARC Churches. And one of their statements is that you want to be the most, you want to have the best website in your city. That's something that you want to do. So if I was a small church, that is some place that I can like stand out amongst mega churches is by really diving in deep on our online presence, specifically our website, and really standing out in that area. So I would nail that. And then just doing that though doesn't get people onto your website. So then you have to find ways to get people onto your website. And the way I would do that is probably the Google Ad Grant, which is a you get $10,000 a month in free Google ads that any nonprofit can apply for. So there's a link down in the description if you want to figure out if your church is eligible for it. If you are small or large, doesn't matter. Almost every church that's set up as a nonprofit can get it. So I would get that. So use that that link in the description to see if you can get it or not. But that's what I would probably do, Ryan.
And that answered our next question that we had from We Do Ebby. I don't know. I probably botched that. Whatever. So he said he needed the Google grant for his church. How does he get started? So we just mentioned that for
sure. Yeah, Google, use the eligibility checker down there. And it really takes like 45 seconds. You can figure out if you can get started on that. That's the first step. And then from there, we'll give you all the links from that eligibility checker on where do you go next? What's my next step? We provide it as a service. We can help you manage it. Or you can do it yourself and try to learn Google Ads and do some of that kind of stuff if you don't know how to do it already. So, but the eligibility checker is totally free. I hope everybody uses it.
Yeah, next question is Google grant related as well from Isoejuo Santiago. They said, does the Google ad grant allow you to advertise on YouTube?
Ah, shoots. I wish it did.
I know.
But unfortunately, no. There are some workarounds kind of to this. Like, so if you're a church and you put sermons on YouTube, you can send people to your site and then you can have your YouTube sermons on there on your site, or you can link from your site off to your YouTube channel. So, but can you have that one click that that goes to your YouTube channel, or can you put YouTube ads like video ads on YouTube videos? No, the Google ad grant is only for search. So it's a search-based ad. So yeah, unfortunately you got to pay if you want to put them on YouTube videos.
Yep, there you go. But I get that question a lot now too. So this next one is from She San Osan. Why or what I find myself wondering is whether the church has become spiritually complacent when it comes to hearing the word. On the other hand, we can easily spend over 2 hours on social media. So what exactly is the challenge with our generation? And this looks like a younger guy that asked this. So he said, basically in a nutshell, why is it so challenging for people to sit through a 45-minute sermon but easily scroll on social media for hours? And what can do about it?
Yeah. Okay, so I like to deal in reality. And I suppose you could make a case that there's a spiritual like reason for this. Like it's, you know, that there's something over our eyes that makes it harder for us. But I'm kind of much more practical in this. And to say it plainly, to the actual question, scrolling social media for a few hours is much more interesting than your sermons. Like, that's the only way to like actually do it. Like, if our sermons were as interesting as that, then we would be good. But I think the opposite, like, of just thinking about it, because we're so used to being so highly entertained in the videos that we watch, the social media that we scroll. And again, if you're measuring it against social media, these are algorithms that are so tailored to know exactly what's going to push your button and make you stay on there as long as you possibly can.
Yeah.
And I am confident that if we spent the amount of time that social media channels spend on building their algorithms to keep you on the site. If we did that same thing with our sermons and crafted them and spent so many hundreds of hours on every sermon, working through the exact right language and making sure people are really engaged, that yes, people would stay just as engaged with our content if we did it that way. The fact is that just that's not a realistic option that we have for almost every church. But I think the best communicators, they do these kinds of things, right? So like, you know, is Stephen Furtick a great communicator? Absolutely. Like by himself, yes. Does him and his team spend hours and hours crafting their messages and nailing the camera angles and thinking about the illustrations and having the props and doing all the stuff that they do? Also, yes. So that's why the most engaging teachers are generally those that are very good at it and spend a lot of time doing it. So I guess all that to say, let's not beat ourselves up. Like it's okay. If we're comparing ourselves against things that are intentionally addictive, we'll almost certainly, you know, come out wanting in that area. But let it be a challenge to us at the same time to craft better messages that are actually going to help people kind of take those next steps and stay engaged and do those kinds of things. As a preacher, I'm preaching this weekend. I know that that's kind of one of my chief aims is to not just speak the gospel, but to actually do it in an engaging way that keeps people engaged. So that's my 2 cents.
No, that's good. And also, when I think of social media too, when you're listening to a message, you're sitting there, captive audience for, I guess, 45 minutes or so. But social media, you know, I find myself, even if I spend more time there during the day, I'm taking in bite-sized chunks of content and then taking a break. So there's a difference too in the way it's digested. Or taken in. So next one comes from Fruitful Teens. They said, thanks for your videos. I'm not a church, but I've started a channel hoping to offer teens and parents of teens encouragement and advice on life's challenges from a biblical perspective. Do you have any advice on how I can increase audience engagement? Well, that's really cool.
Oh, cool. So I guess they're thinking, like, I don't really think of ourselves as this, but I guess we're Christian content creators at this point.
So
we're church content creators, at least helping pastors is what we do here. So,
great question. So they say, how can Christian content creators increase engagement?
Yeah, good question. So I think that if we're talking about like video content, that's what I'm going to assume we're talking about because they're responding to a video that we did and this is what we primarily do. It's a couple of things I would say is number one, like your packaging around your content is so much more important than you actually realize. And by packaging, what do I mean? I mean specifically your title and your thumbnail for YouTube videos specifically, but this is also for other channels like Instagram and TikTok. You're able to do thumbnails and things on there. But you got to remember that, like, unless you'll never engage someone that never clicks on your content. And the first goal to engage people is to get them to click. So I got to tell you, like, we spend a lot of time, like, we honestly, like, here at Reach Right, small channel that we are, we have someone who is a full-time graphic designer that all that she, like, half of her time, I think, is probably spent making thumbnails for our videos.
Yep.
So, like, 20 hours a week crafting these thumbnails. And so as far as volume, we do 2 full-length videos every week, and then we do probably about 10 or so short videos. And so just doing that, and not just like the actual design of it, but thinking of the idea. I don't thinking of what the idea for this thumbnail is going to look like. And we always do 2 versions of it because you can do an A/B test on YouTube. And so we spend a lot of time getting to do that, and it has paid huge dividends. Like when we started to really take these thumbnails seriously, we've seen in some cases like 4 or 5x the number of clicks on a video with very similar videos just by really doubling down on the title and thumbnail side. So that's one thing I would say. And then beyond that, for engagement, I think really focusing on the hook part of every piece of video content you do. So before we film this episode, what you and I do, Ian, is we get out there and we film like potential hooks that our video editors can use to make short videos with. So we do things like, for this one, we might say, I've heard it said that content is hard to make for Christians, but is it really that bad? You know, we do that into the camera to make an interesting hook. And that's just totally spitballing. I didn't plan that one. That's a bad hook. That's not what I'm talking about.
Hook. But
But I guess what I would say is think about that. And really, like for these videos that we do, we script out a hook for every single one of our long form videos. We don't, this isn't scripted. I'm not reading anything right now about what to say. We do this ad lib. We have kind of a general outline of these questions and stuff. But we have a hook that we write down and we hit it word for word that really it piques people's interest, and then it kind of encourages them to stick around. That's how you increase engagement in those areas. So the two things, I guess, to sum up, packaging, thumbnails and titles, and then really nailing your hook. I think that's my best advice for you.
It's good. It's good. And hopefully helpful. And keep up the good work. I think that's a really cool effort, especially being a dad of teenagers. So,
awesome.
But this next one from Office Hours 7928. Is it a good idea for the pastor we are replacing to stay a member of the church?
No. It's terrible. That's a bad idea. No, it's not even, not only is it not a good idea, it's a bad idea in almost every case. And I get it. Like I think that I hear so many churches. So let me give you some perspective on this. I'm a pastor of a church. I run Reach Right. For many years, I was an administrator in a district of churches, and I oversaw a large group of other churches. And we've been making this kind of content for years. And so I just have lots of anecdotes about people that have this idea that, yeah, I know generally it's a bad idea to stick around, but our relationship is different.
Right.
Like, this is just different for us. And, you know, we're not that kind of, we love each other. And so we're not like, there's no tension here.
Yeah.
It's not a good idea still. Like, you need to have that distance. I could see that possibly many years down the road that person could come back, maybe after the current pastor retires as well or something like that. I've seen some instances where someone comes back 10 or 15 years later. Yeah. But almost certainly, it's always a bad idea for the pastor to stick around at that church after he has been replaced. Certainly if he's been replaced, you should never do that. If he's been asked to step down. If he retires, I know that a lot of times there's a temptation to let that ride. I think it usually is bad. And it's not that it's like, I get the heart behind it and everything, but what happens is that it always will happen is that people that had an attachment to that old pastor, and that's all of your church because he was the pastor there before, they're going to use him as a sounding board. They're going to come to him and say, you know, he's just not like you used to be, pastor.
Yeah.
This new guy, it's not productive, and it's the opposite of helpful. I know you're saying right now, in my case, we're different. Our church isn't like that. That would never happen here. Like, it just doesn't work. I know as someone who has stepped down from churches and did it as healthy as I could. I got out of Dodge. I left. Mm. And still, people contact me and say, man, Thomas, can you believe what this guy's doing? Oh, man, he's really wanting me to step in still and use whatever clout I have to get involved. And I have to say, I love him. I'm actually for him. He's doing it for a reason and trying to stand up for the guy who replaced me in those cases.
Yeah.
Just puts you in an awkward position. It always happens. So I think, can I come out and say 100% of the time you should never do it? Maybe not. But I would very strongly say, like, it's not a good idea.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. Well, this next one here from, where are they at? This is KC9111. What do you think of a pastor who scolds his congregation for not giving enough to the guest speaker? He said that he was not happy with the offering and is going to leave the collection bucket up for another week. This is a fun, it's funny, but not funny, honestly. But it says, is it toxic if my pastor scolded the congregation to not give is what they should have to the guest speaker? So,
yeah. It's tricky, right? Because it's like, so obviously from this person's perspective, if you take this at face value, if a pastor says, I'm disappointed in you, church, like you should have given more. I expected you to give $5,000 and you only gave $2,500. What's wrong with you? If that's what we're talking about, obviously poorly done. At the same time, there is a place, I think, where pastors should have the spiritual authority to speak into their congregation's life about what generosity looks like.
Yeah.
And there probably is a right way that could be said and not come across as a scolding from the pastor there. So
I have I ever done it?
No. I've never tried to encourage my church to give more after they gave a certain amount to a guest speaker or any kind of initiative. I generally find that, kind of to use the metaphor of honey or a carrot or a stick, I find that like a stick is not the right approach when it comes to talking about giving. Like, you know, you're bad at giving, you need to get better, you need to get better is not as effective as, man, I'm so blessed by your generosity and just telling stories of generosity of when people have given. I think that's a more effective approach. So to the question of, is it wrong or toxic? It could be done possibly in a non-toxic way, but I think as far as a principle of coaching your church on what generosity looks like, I think that's a healthy thing that pastors need to find a way to communicate properly.
Yeah, that's good stuff. So last one here that we have to read is from Mammoth Agui, 9795. They were asking, how is Pastor Appreciation Month even biblical?
Hmm.
How is it relevant biblically is specifically what they said.
Yeah, I think that there's a foundation. Scripturally, we're called to, you know, they're worthy of a double portion. We see those kind of language around what church leaders are worthy of. And so I think that there certainly is a foundation there. I think that's enough to make a foundation. Is there a foundation for the Hallmark holiday of Pastor Appreciation Month and Day? Obviously not. That's not a mandated holiday in Scripture.
Yeah.
But as far as the principle, I think that we should operate from the idea that like pastors are worthy of double honor. And I think that it's healthy because we have days where we celebrate everything, that pastors should have days or months or times where we do kind of generally all agree it's a good time to honor those that lead our churches there. So is there a foundation? I think so. There's at least a foundation for it. And I think it's a good thing to do. We actually have a whole video that we did about how to do Pastor Appreciation Month the right way. That's some examples of like what you should or shouldn't give to your pastor. This is coming from a pastor and giving you real perspective on those kinds of things. So hopefully that's helpful to you. But yeah, I think there's a foundation for it, and I'm going to keep doing it.
There you go. There you go. We believe our pastors should be appreciated for sure. They do a lot of work. So, but, well, these were fun. And again, thanks for all that have commented and everything. Means a lot to us, doesn't it, Thomas?
It does. Yeah, guys, it really is great. We do want to respond to your comments. We hope to make this a regular occurrence, unless you hate it. If you hated this episode, then don't comment. We won't ever do this again. But if you do have some comments for us, drop them in there, and we'll try to get it into the next mailbag episode. Thanks, guys, for being a part of the Reach Right family, and we'll see you next time.
See you.